does this Shmiras HaLashon Chabura, and you know, some of the guys walk out, which they're right, they're allowed to walk out, it's okay. But the idea of getting up here every day and while people are taking off their tefillin, turning Bittul Zman into something that's not Bittul Zman, and hearing about Shmiras HaLashon and taking on that achrayus is a very, very big deal. So I appreciate and thank you for that inspiration. I get to shul every morning, and I try my best to get here on time. Sometimes I even get here early, and pretty religiously, every single morning, I had the schus of observing Josh Lieberman and Ike in this chabrusa. Shana Bet, Shana Aleph, learning together is very, very chashuv. And I get inspired when I see young men. There are other people who learn early in the morning as well, but the daily Shana Bet Shana Aleph thing that they have going is very special and it's very chashuv. So I thank them for that inspiration. There's two guys in this year I just want to call out. I think I've called them out before, but they're tall, and they come in pairs, and that's the Gdanskis. One second, don't clap. But the Gdanskis are tall. That means they're noticeable. When you're tall, you can't, like, you're above the radar. You're noticed. And they're tall. And they're twins. And they look a little bit alike. And they're noticeable. And what I get inspired by is I always notice them, like, where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there. They're davening every night consistently at their siddurim, steiging away. And that, to me, is a big deal. It's a big deal. I get a lot of inspiration for the Gdansky twins. And I want to thank you for that daily, every Seder, every single day, that inspiration. I don't know what they did over there in the Gdansky house in Englewood, New Jersey, but your parents did something very, very right. So, okay. I would like to... I'm going to try and speak a little fast, but there's a lot I want to talk about, and I want to build off of the parsha, and then I want to get into some things that I think are relevant to probably just about every single person in this room, on some level or another, including myself. And I also want to recognize a little bit, if time permitting, at the end of the sicha, Harav Sachs, Olav Hashalom, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And I want to address that a little bit as well. But as we, this week's parasha is Parshas Chayisara. And it's a little bit of an interesting name that we call Chayisara, but the parasha is full of death. And that's really what dominates a lot of the parasha. The opening of the parasha is the death of Sarah, even though it's called Chayisara. The parasha ends off with the death of Yishmael. Okay, nunu. But we also have the death of Avraham Avinu. So the sandwich of the parasha beginning and the end is death. The death of Sarah and the death of Avraham Avinu. And the reality is that, to be honest, the past weeks, for me at least, as I get older, like, people dying actually has a real impact on me. And we've seen death, unfortunately, from celebrities. You know, game show hosts have died in the past couple of days. Rav Sachs, at the age of 72, not terribly old, passed away this week. Rav David Feinstein passed away this week. The Rav of my shul, Rav Chaim Malinowitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who is actually your Rebbe. You never met him, but every single person in this room has learned from the Rav of our shul, Rav Chaim Zev Malinowitz, Zatzal. His yahrzeit was today, and he is your Rebbe too. He died very prematurely at the age of 67, 1 year ago, and I was going to speak about him as well, but I'm not sure I'm going to get to it. Why is that? Why do I say he's your Rebbe? Because he is has been the editor-in-chief of the art school Gemaras, the Schottenstein Gemaras, for the past 20-odd years, and therefore he's probably been your biggest teacher over the course of your lifetime, is art school and Gemara, and that's all him. So there's been a lot of loss and there's a lot of death, and this week's parsha is about death, yet the parsha is called Chayei Sara. So I want to address a little bit of concept from this parasha and then take it from there. So the Torah opens up and tells us about Sarah's life, and it tells us she was very famous pasuk tells us that she lived to 127 years old, but the way the Torah formulates those 127 years is it tells us, Vayu chayei Sarah 100 shana, 20 shana, v'sheva shana. Shnei chayei Sarah. She was 127. And Chazal explained in Rashi, brings down that she had a certain purity to her, the purity of a seven-year-old, the physical purity, no blemishes of a seven-year-old. She had that for her whole life. And at 20, when she is pater from onshin, a person 20 years old is still exempt from punishment, she had that her whole life. And she brought some of the purity of the seven-year-old, to her onshin, the 20-year-old, throughout the rest of her life. That's what Rashi says. The Rav Shamsofel Hirsch has a different idea, which I think is very relevant. He says that there are three stages in a young person's development. Stage one is what we call childhood. 0 to 7, when you're really, really, really a kid. 7 to 20, your first 20 years, 7 to 20, you're moving into this stage where you're, childhood heading towards adulthood. Adolescence, adulthood. And that is what you hit at 20. At 20, you're supposed to be a full-fledged adult. And Rav Hirsch writes that she too brought, she was a perfect child, so to speak. At the age of 7, she brought that to her adolescence. She was a perfect adolescent. She achieved shleimus until 20, and then she brought that to adulthood and achieved that adulthood at that shleimus as well. So as we are in that kind of ending, that second stage, the stage of 18, 19, 20, we're moving towards the end of it, adolescence, the lessons we can learn from Sarah and this parasha, I think, are very, very relevant. When we look at the parasha, there are three core stories in the parasha. Story number one, the death of Sarah and the purchase by Avram Avinu of Maras HaMachpelah. Story number two is the shidduch of Yitzhak Avinu with Rivka. And story number three is the remarriage of Avram to Keturah and him building a family with Keturah, this woman called Keturah. And the question that I have and I want to explore very quickly is there any common theme in these three stories? Is there any linkage? Is there any message that we have for us that maybe also tells us about Sarah Imenu? And we are told, Sarah dies, Avram buys Maras HaMachpelah. When he approaches the Anshei Ches, and he approaches Ephron HaChiti, he describes himself in a very striking way. He calls himself, Ger Vitoshav Anochi Imachem. I am a ger, a stranger here. And I am a toshav. I live here. I'm a resident here. And that's a contradiction. Ger v'toshav is not the same thing. You're a stranger or are you a toshav, a citizen? What is it all about? And Rav Soloveitchik, in a very, very famous shiur that he gave in 1964, develops the idea that truth is that the Jew in this world lives a dichotomous existence. And we live an existence where on the one hand we are toshavim, and we are part of the citizenry of our state, of our country, of the entire world. We vote, we're citizens, we're patriots, we're neighbors, we're loyal to our governments, to our institutions. We are toshavim, and we certainly can call ourselves Americans, Canadians, English. That is, we're part of the community that we live in. We are toshavim. But on the other hand, if you really understand the role of a Jew and what we're really all about as well, we don't really fit in. Our customs are different customs. We perhaps are embarrassed when we have to daven in public. It's the end of Zman Mincha. We have to embarrass. We have to go ahead and daven in Shmona Esrei. Back in the day when I was a kid, what you used to do is you used to go into this thing called a phone booth, which actually used to exist, and you pretend you go on the phone and you'd be davening Shmona Esrei. We're not so comfortable perhaps wearing our tzitzis out or even our tzitzis at all in the workplace, or our yarmulkes in the workplace, and we're a little bit awkward. We don't really, really fit in. We are strangers, gerim, as well. And that is the human condition, the Jewish condition, in a world of gulos. On the one hand, we are toshavim. On the other hand, we need to understand crystal clear that we are gerim, and we don't really, really fit in. And the second we start assimilating and not appreciating that we are strangers, we're not really, really part of this culture and society, that's when we start to lose our identity, we start to lose our connectivity, and we start to assimilate. So as Avram Avinu is purchasing, and he makes sure, I don't want this for free. I don't want Maras and Machpelah for free, because if I get it for free, I am beholden to you. Then I owe you something. You have something on me. And Avram has to navigate this dichotomous existence of, on the one hand, being a Toshav, a citizen amongst the community, and a Ger. That is story number one. Story number two is the Shidduch of Yitzchak. And it's an amazing story. And the Torah spends a lot of time on it, but when you think about it, it's very, very striking, because Yitzchak's not a player. Yitzchak's not there. Eliezer is sent out to find the Shidduch, to find the wife of Yitzchak. And Avram is a little bit concerned about who he's going to come back with. And therefore, in Perek Chav Dalet Pasuk Gimel, Avram makes Eliezer take a shvuah. And he says, Ve'ashbiacha b'Hashem Elokei Hashamayim Elokei Aretz. I want you to take a shvuah. Asher lo tikach isha livni. Do not take a wife for my son. Mibnos ha'kna'ani. From the girls of Canaan, Asher Ani Yosef Bekirba. Do not take a girl for Yitzchak from Bnos HaKanani, Asher Anochi Yosef Bekirba. And the Mefarshim are bothered. Are there any extra words in that pasuk? Mandy, can you just put on that red switch over there, the air conditioner? Are there any... Bo, do you want to handle the air conditioning? It's on. Okay, good. Are there any extra words in that pasuk? Do not take a girl from Bnos HaKanani, Asher Ani Yosef Bekirbo. Why do we need Asher Ani Yosef Bekirbo? I know where Avram lives. I know he's from Canaan. Why is Avram so opposed that he should take a girl from Bnos Canaan? What's the problem with Bnos Canaan? Oh, you'll tell me, Bnos Canaan, they're old, they're Avodah Zarah. They're into bad stuff. Oh, so where are we going to go? To Haran. And we're going to get someone from the house of Besua, from Lavan, and that's going to be any better? What exactly is Avram's agenda in not taking a girl from Bnos Canaan? This is a rhetorical question. So the Kli Yakar gives a fantastic answer which is relevant to every single one of them. The Kli Yakar writes as follows. Whoever was going to marry Yitzchak was going to have to undergo change. She was going to come from a house of Ovdei Avodah Zarah, of pagans. She was going to have to change. So now, he could take a girl from Haran out of town, or he can take a girl from the local village in town. Avram says, there is no way we can get a girl for Yitzchak from in town, from local, from down the block. Why not? Not because out of towners are better. That's not the pshat. The pshat is, whoever was going to marry Yitzchak was going to have to change. And in order to make a change and be different, you have to uproot. You cannot be in your same exact place. If you're in the same exact place, if you took a girl from down the block, she's still hanging out with her same friends. Every other Shabbos, they're going to her house for Shabbos. And she's in her regular comfort zone. She cannot change. In order for her to change and be different, be the wife of Yitzchak Avinu, she has to be uprooted from her hometown, relocated, and now be able to look at life fresh. Look at things different. Be different. And that's why he says, don't take a girl from Bnos HaKanani, Asher Ani Yosef Bekirbo. Because we live here, and she's going to move in with us. We can't have a girl who's from down the block from the same town. She needs to be uprooted. And by the way, it's not just something that you find by Rivka and Yitzchak. Anytime someone is going to make real moves in terms of who he is and where he's going. Look at Avram himself. Avram, to forge his identity, requires a lech lecha, me'artzecha, u'mimalach. Yaakov Avinu has his biggest move, his biggest moment, when he crosses a river and he's by himself, away from his family, and he has this midnight battle with Sarah Shel Esav, with the Malach, and that's where he transforms himself from Yaakov to Yisrael. Moshe has his first revelation in a desert, by the snare, all by himself, and Klal Yisrael, on a national level, have their first revelation as well, away from the community, away from civilization, at Har Sinai. That's story number two. Story number three is Avram's marriage to Keturah. Chazal tell us Keturah perhaps was Hagar. I wonder where that came from. Well, I'll tell you where I think it came from. He took a wife called Keturah, and they had kids. Zimran, Yokshan, Medan, Midian, a lot of kids. A lot of kids. And then the pasuk tells us, he had all these kids with Keturah. His kids. Vayiten Avraham es kol asher lo li Yitzchak. And he gave everything. His legacy, his estate, everything he had to give to Yitzchak ulivnei hapilagshim. Asher la Avraham natan Avraham atanot. And to the sons of Keturah, he gave gifts. He sent them off with generous presents. And then what did he do? Vayeshalchem me'al Yitzchak b'no. And he sent them away from his son Yitzchak. He sent the B'nai Keturah away from his son Yitzchak. What was Avram doing? And where did he get this idea from to send them away? The B'nai Keturah, the B'nai HaPilakshin, had the possibility of being a pernicious and negative influence on Yitzchak. And Avram saw that. And when it came to securing Yitzchak and his future, I have to clear away, send away the B'nai Keturah. And I have to make sure that Yitzchak has a wholesome and proper environment. Where did Avram learn to do this for? So if you look at last week's parsha, in last week's parsha we see that Yishmael is hanging around, and Yishmael is having a negative influence on Yitzchak, and Sarah Imenu, Chayei Sarah, is very sensitive to the influence that Yishmael is going to have, might have on Yitzchak. And what does Sarah say? Vatera Sarah, she sees what's going on. Vatomer Avram, Garesh Ha'ama Hazos Es Bena, send her away. Ki lo yirash ben ama hazos im b'ni im Yitzchak, because I cannot have Yitzchak influenced by Yishmael. And Avram objected. Vayera Hadover, how can I send my own flesh and blood away? And by Yomer Elokim El Avram, my wife's name is Sarah. She loves this pasuk. Vayomer Elokim El Avram, Al Yei Rabbe Necha, don't worry. Kol Asher Tomar Elecha Sarah, Shema Bekola. Whatever Sarah says, listen to what she's saying. She knows what she's talking about. What Sarah was the person in Avram's orbit that protected the family, that protected the environment, with the full understanding that Avram is a ger v'toshav, and he's doing kiruv, and he's doing hakasas orachim, he's bringing everything into the house. It was Sarah who stands al pesach ha'ohel at the doorway and serves as the filter and serves as the person who makes sure that if there are going to be any bad influences, those influences are not going to penetrate the home, are not going to impact what is really going on. That was who Sarah was. And if this parsha recognizes her death, but this parsha is all about Chayei Sarah, where Avram understands Gerva Toshav, Avram understands that if he doesn't marry off Yitzhak to the right girl, or they find themselves in the wrong environment, it's not going to work. And then when you have the Pnei Apilakshim, to make sure they don't influence, just like Yishmael could have influenced, to make sure the environment is pristine, is pure, and is wholesome. This is who Sarah was. And if you ask me, what is a famous book out there, written by a Mevaseret alumnus, the challenge of our generation? It is how to navigate the outside influences of the society around us and to make sure that those influences do not, Rahmana Litzlan, steer us way off course. And one of the challenges of your generation, of your yeshiva years, is exactly this challenge. Avram Avinu understood that for Rivka to make moves, she needs to be uprooted. She needs to relocate. If we're going to get a girl from Bnos Knan for Yitzchak, and she's hanging out with the same friends every other week, back home for Shabbos, watching the same movies and the same TV shows and doing the same shtus, there is no way anything meaningful is going to happen. So she needs to be uprooted, relocated, and then moves can be made. Then she can become the wife of Yitzhak. Then she can become Rivka Imenu. And if I may get nostalgic for a moment and flashback 37 years, a mere 37 years, when I was a Shana Aleph youngster on my way to Yeshiva. So again, very different world. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that world. It's 1983, and I'm an MTA graduate, and I'm getting ready for my year in Israel. Now, I used to be a very big Met fan. From 1974 until 1982, the Mets were the 2000 Jets. They were terrible. Horrible 2020 Jets. That's what I meant. 2020 Jets. 2020 Jets. They were a laughingstock. And they were a terrible, terrible team. They got to the World Series in 73, and then basically downhill since then. But I was a loyal fan. And when Dave Kingman would get up to the plate, I was with him. And when Pat Zachary was giving up 6-8 runs a game, I was there. And when they were winning 50, 60 games a season, I was with them. Through all of the pain and suffering. But then comes 83. The summer of 83, and all of a sudden, for the first time that I can remember, they're in a pennant race. And they have these young stars that are coming up the system. A Darryl Strawberry is coming up the system. A pitcher named Doc Gooden is now in the major leagues throwing 99 miles an hour. And Ron Darling has some Chashuvim. And they're in a pennant race with the St. Louis Cardinals in August 1983. First time that I can remember. And I get on a plane. Couldn't believe it. I'm going to miss this. I get on a plane. And I get to Yeshiva. I just want to tell you how it was following the New York Mets in 1983 in Yeshiva. These guys did not exist. In fact, cell phones did not exist. In fact, the internet did not exist. As my children like to say, Abba, you lived in the olden days. Indeed, indeed. Got on the plane. If I wanted to know what happened, where the standings were, where the Mets were holding. We somehow on Friday got a hold of the Jerusalem Post, and we saw the standings, which were standings from Tuesday, 3-4 days late. We did our best. I like football too, and on a Sunday evening, we took transistor radios, and we go up to the roof of the yeshiva and see if we can catch the fourth quarter of the game of the week on Armed Forces Radio coming out of Iraq. Once in a while, we caught something. That's what it was like. Calling home? Well, there was one payphone for about 200 people. It was very expensive. And we didn't really call home. I spoke home once every 3-4 weeks. We actually wrote letters. My father, Alav HaShalom, used to cut out articles from Sports Illustrated, from the New York Times sports section, put it in this thing called an envelope, put a stamp on it, and I would get it 10 days later, and I would read it voraciously. That's what things were like. You didn't call home, you didn't text home. You send some letters. We used to, once in a while, like once every 3 months, you'd send a, you'd like record to your parents, and you'd send it in the mail, a cassette tape, and they'd kind of catch up a little bit. That's what life was like 37 years ago. There was no Netflix. There was no following sports, no fantasy leagues, no WhatsApp, no cell phones, no movies, no nothing. But guess what? You were uprooted. You left America and you were in Israel. And basically, yeah, there were restaurants and yes, there was places to go, meet friends. But in terms of really being uprooted from one's home, culture, and society, you were uprooted. Which meant you could start to think and you could start to get into learning, and you were not distracted, and it was actually incredibly liberating to be able to be free, to be unshackled. And should you be curious, the Mets, true to form, didn't go anywhere. They came in second place to the Cardinals, and but it didn't matter. Because once they were out of sight, they were literally out of mind. That's what life was like 37 years ago when we came to Israel for a year or two. Flashing forward to you guys. It's a very different world and we're not going back. No one's suggesting we're going back. But I do want to address your challenges and why you have to think about how you're going to navigate the next 5-6 months. Because you can still be stuck in all of the sports and all of the movies and all of the stuff, or you can figure out how best to extricate yourself just a bit in order to maximize your ability to be free. And I'm not talking right now, I am going to be talking about smartphones, but I'm not talking about schmutz and pornography and that. That's not what I'm talking about. That's a whole different discussion, and it's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about freedom. Freedom to think, freedom to be your best. And I want you to tell you something. These guys are absolutely incredible. They're amazing. And they call them smartphones because they are so smart. In this little half a pound instrument, and I have a very, very old cheap one. I have a camera, I have a video camera, TV, photo album, video, a phone, newspapers, sports, magazines. I have a New York Public Library in this thing. I have a Seder Ashas, Shulchan Aruch. You guys have games. You have everything you want in this tiny little thing, everything. Everything. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. But I also want to tell you, These guys are really, really smart. But they're smart. They make you and me, really, really stupid. And I'm going to explain why. First of all, I have a good book over here. I'm going to read from this book. Our book's still in the world. This book is called Irresistible. And it is a book about the rise of addictive technology and the business of keeping us hooked. I'm going to read you just the first page of this book. One page. At an Apple event in January 2010, Steve Jobs unveiled the iPad. And he said as follows, "What this device does is extraordinary. It offers the best way to browse the web, way better than a laptop and way better than a smartphone. It's an incredible experience. It's phenomenal for mail. It's a dream to type on." For 90 minutes, Jobs explained why the iPad was the best way to look at photos, listen to music, take classes on iTunes U, browse Facebook, play games, navigate thousands of apps. He believed everyone should own an iPad. But he refused to let his kids use the device. In late 2010, Jobs told the New York Times journalist Nick Bilton that his children had never used the iPad. "We limit how much technology our kids use in the house." Bilton later discovered, that's the author, that other tech giants imposed similar restrictions. Chris Anderson, the former editor of Wired, enforced strict time limits on every device in his home because we have seen the dangers of technology firsthand. His five children were never allowed to use screens in their bedrooms. Ian Williams, founder of Blogger, Twitter, and Medium, bought hundreds of books for his young sons, but refused to give them an iPad. And Leslie Gold, the founder of an analytics company, imposed a strict no screen time during the week rule on her kids. Walter Isaacson, no relation, who ate dinner with the Jobs family while researching his biography of Steve Jobs, told Bilton that no one ever pulled out an iPad or computer. The kids did not seem addicted at all to devices. It seemed as if the people producing tech products were following the cardinal rule of drug dealing. Never get high on your own supply. It's the first page of this book, Irresistible. But I want to go a little weiter. I have an article from the Wall Street Journal. It's titled, "How Smartphones Hijack Our Minds and What It Does to Us." Just a few studies I'm going to cite, which I think are very, very striking, because I would like you guys to be smart. But I know that smartphones have the risk of making you stupid. Study number one, cited in this article, and of course we all understand attention issues and the beeping and all of that. I'm not even going there. But I want to share with you the following. They did a study in the University of California, San Diego. 520 undergraduate students. And they gave them an exam. Same exam. And the three groups of students. One group had their phone off on their desk. Second group had their phone off in their pockets or in their purse. Third group had their phone back in their rooms. And time in, time out, every single time, the students that had the phones in their rooms scored better on the tests than the ones that had in their pockets, and the ones that had it on their desks scored consistently the worst. And the phones were off. The mere presence of the phones has a deleterious impact on our concentration. And And certainly if the phone is on. They asked these students, these three groups, "Do you think the presence of your phone had any impact on your performance on the exam?" And they all announced no impact. Yet, consistently the ones with the phones closer to them perform poorer on the exams. Another study, very fascinating study. They try to, and this is really gets to the point I want to make. They wanted to highlight the following. This is what they had two groups, 100 people, 50 people, whatever the number was, two groups. Asked them to type data into a computer, just information, random facts. When did the space shuttle Columbia disintegrate over Texas? February 2003, random information, facts, just general facts. Each group got 40 random information to type into a computer. Group number one was told, group number one was told that the computer's hard drive is going to be deleted right after you put the information in. And group number two was told the hard drive is going to store the information. A day or two later, they asked the two groups to recall what they typed in, the information. Group one, which understood that the hard drive was going to be deleted, remembered the information much better than group two, who assumed they would just be able to pick it out of the computer should they need it. But that is what that means, and I want to bring this home. Most of us understand very well that any bit of information we want in the world is at our fingertips. And we think falsely that what is here is here. That's what we think. And the truth is, any bit of information, if I asked you, who was the president of the United States in the year 1814, you could just look it up, and you'll have the information within seconds. And that's great. I'm not asking you. And that's wonderful. Every bit of information is right here, and that is pretty incredible. However, I would like to tell you what knowledge is, what wisdom is. And this is not me. This is a lot of people that are much smarter than I am. What knowledge and wisdom is having a database of information that now you can work with, that now you can analyze, that you can apply, that you can maven dover mito dover. In other words, you need a database here in order then to work with that information. And one of the unintended consequences of these guys being so smart is that we've downloaded all of the possible information that we can have up here, we've downloaded over here and it's gone from here, which means that we are much less wise than we could be. And that's why this article is titled, How Smartphones Hijack Our Minds. And there's a lot of truth to this, and I'm not even getting into it, but that's obviously a big topic. The distractions constantly of the buzzing and of the checking one's WhatsApp and what it does to your blood pressure, how it spikes your anxiety if you're missing out, if you're not, and we're checking our phones some 150 times a day and what that does to our concentration level, to our ability to focus, all of that is exceptionally, exceptionally relevant. It's an amazing machine. It's an amazing machine. And it absolutely has transformed life as we know it over the past 10 years. But don't delude yourself into thinking, because these guys are so smart, that makes me so smart. Because that is delusional, and it would be a mistake. So I want to hearken back nostalgically to 37 years ago. I can tell you, getting into learning, getting into yeshiva, having a strong growth-oriented environment around you, that's always tough. That's always challenging. There's always things that are pulling us in different directions. That was true 37 years ago too. However, your challenge is much more difficult than mine was, because once a person gave, like got into things, my biggest distraction back then, as I like to quip when I present the yeshiva, is either you got into learning or you hung out with the cows on the kibbutz. And at some point, the cows just didn't smell good enough. So you got into learning. And when you got into learning, you really got into learning. Because what else were you going to do? And you became invested, and you pushed, and you achieved. You had easy opportunities to achieve very big things. Because there was nothing else. Today, there is everything else. Which means, on the one hand, we could say, we got no chance. That's not the mahalach. That's not the mahalach. I'm not suggesting, as some of you might think, on that side of the room, okay, so get rid of your smartphones. That's not what I'm saying. It's not the suggestion, that's not happening. That is not where we're at. But where we are at is to develop in ourselves a sense of discipline, to understand the lessons of Chaye Sarah, of Sarah's life. Because it doesn't have to be a Yishmael. A Yishmael could be right over here in terms of its distractions and what it's doing to our focus and our concentration. And therefore figure out a way to be disciplined. I'm not saying don't check your phone, don't use your phone, but figure out a way to discipline yourself. Leave your phone in your rooms so you can go ahead and be free a little bit. Take advantage of becoming a real chacham, because sometimes these guys limit our abilities to be chacham. And that's the message I wanted to share. I have a whole second sicha to give over, which I'm not going to give over. But the sicha is words of Rav Jonathan Sacks, Zatzal. I just want to say one or two sentences. But I really spent a lot of time with him this afternoon. He quotes from Shakespeare, as only he can. He says, some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. And Rabbi Sacks said about himself, which I don't think is true, but he says, I wasn't born great. And he says, I didn't achieve greatness. But he says, as part of being part of the family of Knesset Yisrael, I had greatness thrust upon me. As an heir of Avram Avinu, who was followed by 2.4 billion, he says, Christians and 1.6 billion Muslims and 13 million Jews, by being the heir of Avram Avinu, a descendant of Moshe Rabbeinu, of David HaMelech of the Nevi'im, we have greatness thrust upon us. And in a very eloquent way, he describes what that responsibility means. And next week I'll perhaps flesh it out a little bit. But we have a great achrayus. And I know that growing up in the world that you grew up in, so many things going on, and so many things distracting us, so many things pulling us in so many different directions. And now we're here. And now it's time. And we can kind of continue being that hamster, just going in circles, struggling ups and downs all the time because we're stuck with all of the stuff that we happen to be stuck with. Or we can do our best for the next year or two, extricate ourselves a little bit, free ourselves up a little bit, so we can become smart. And I promise you, for sure, it's only going to be in your long-term best interest. You don't need me to say this. Listen to Steve Jobs. All of us saw them. Listen to them on Twitter. And what they did with their children. They made billions of dollars on this stuff. But they wouldn't give it to their kids. That's pretty telling. It's pretty something to think about. So give us all a bracha. To realize that we might not be born great. And we might not be achieve greatness on our own, but we have greatness thrust upon us. And we should be zoche to realize that greatness, to maximize that greatness, to see what it means to be an heir of Avram Avinu and of Sarah Imenu. And understand that you can be the Avram, the iconoclast, who goes out and changes the world. But you need your Sarah Imenu, who can say, Yishmo, get out. The Nea Pilakshim, get out. Be standing as the filter by the door that makes sure that Avram can achieve everything that he's destined to achieve. Shali.